two unfortunate examples of why pushing weather minima remains a major link in the chain. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which is available on the internet. Also of Bob Miller Flight Training, flight school at the Lancaster Buffalo Airport in Western New York. And we talk with Bob for his unconventional views on safety, and sometimes we rattle a few cages. Bob, we appreciate your taking some time out for our listeners today.
Well, I trust we won't rattle too many cages this afternoon, Paul, but we'll try.
Well, if we don't, you won't get paid. Bob, you had an article in the most recent edition of Over the Airwaves, the March edition, and this headline probably comes across to some people as a little harsh. Stupid is what stupid does. And you're talking specifically about a Lance Air accident that happened at Portland International Airport in my old stomping grounds. It's kind of a big stick to hit with to call a deceased pilot stupid. How did you come across this evaluation of what happened here?
Paul, and I thought long and hard about using that descriptor, stupid is what stupid does, which is a line from Forrest Gump, the Hollywood presentation movie. I've told my students for years that, and maybe I'm admitting something over the airwaves here that ought not be admitted, but, you know, occasionally I have, as a pilot, as an airman, maybe have come close on a rule or two, maybe regret something that I've done and shouldn't have done. And I think I'm free to say that most of us have bent a rule once or twice, certainly if we're experienced pilots flying in various conditions. But I've also told my students that there are two rules that you will never, ever, not ever find Bob Miller breaking. One is flying under the influence of alcohol in any way, shape, or form, and the other is descending below published minimums on an instrument approach. Those are two rules that I think ought to be emblazoned on the panels of every aircraft in the sky. Now, I don't have any data to back me up, but I do not suspect that there's a lot of driving or flying under the influence of alcohol. There very well could be. But the accident data is replete with particularly IFR accidents where the pilot descended below published minimums in an attempt to get into the airport. And to me, that's playing Russian roulette with about four rounds in a six-chambered revolver. It's near suicidal in doing it. In this particular accident of the Lance Air, now again, I'm only going from what has been published in the NTSB report. But it was clear from the radar track that the individual descended below published minimums in an attempt to get into this airport. And then number two, another rule that has to be followed every time. And that is to comply with the published missed approach procedures whenever in a situation where you're only 200 or 300 feet above the ground and can't see the airport. In this particular instance, the published missed approach procedure was not only not followed according to the NTSB report, but it was the most basic of all instructions contained in virtually every missed approach procedure. And that is the first word, check the approach plates on any procedure. The first word in every missed approach procedure is climb. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing we do is we start a climb. And according to the accident report, the individual turned left, ran into a tree before climbing. And so the turn came before the climb, and the descent was below published minimums. I think those two rules border on something we also call stupid pilot tricks. Now, whether or not there are other factors taking place in the cockpit, whether or not there was an instrument malfunction or an incorrect altimeter setting, I understand there's some litigation now at foot to look at those issues. But based upon what we've seen in the NTSB report, these were just a couple of errors that should never have taken place.
Well, and that lawsuit, frankly, I'm not sure how that'll ever bring anything against Avedon, because the NTSB said that the there was not enough left to evaluate that avionics system after the post-crash fire. But Bob, I want to ask you about the decision, the bad decision maybe that came before the fatal bad decision in this one, and that is one that I think a lot of us may make, and that is the go, no-go decision in the first place. I'm not really familiar with what the weather forecasts were or what the advisories were along this pilot's route, but I think, you know, it's very possible to get into a situation where you are out of back doors and that airport down below you, you can't see, is your only chance.
Well, there is a curious exemption under Part 91 for instrument pilots on an instrument approach. Under Part 91, it's perfectly permissible to execute a procedure, an instrument procedure, that to an airport whose weather is being reported as below minimums. This provision does not exist under Part 121 or Part 135. In other words, as a commercial operator or engaged in commercial operations, we cannot even begin the approach if the reported weather is below published minimums. Now, that's not bad advice for all of us to follow. Just because it's permissible under 91 doesn't mean that we ought to be doing this. And that's the question or point that you're raising, Paul. This airport had weather that was reported below minimums. I suspect he did what I've done in the past and so many of us have done under Part 91, is we'll go down and take a look, see if maybe perchance we can get a break in the clouds or an improvement in the visibility. But utilizing a much more prudent approach, if it's not good enough for airline or commercial operation, we under Part 91 should respect the same rule, and that is as we come upon an airport whose weather is being reported as below instrument minimums, we ought not even attempt it.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Bob, is when he took off, you know, with a plan to land there, he kind of committed half the offense.
Well, yes, and I think we also, in fairness to him, weather changes, and mm-hmm. certainly we have situations where in 1 5-minute period the airport's below minimums, and then that low cloud passes by and it opens up again. He'd have to look at the much. I don't know if he did, and I don't know what the area weather. But if the area weather was just low clouds to begin with, all over, you're absolutely right. He doesn't have much of a back door, and if temperature's a factor, where outside air temperature is below freezing, then we have icing as another contaminating factor. It really begs the question, do I need to go to that airport on this particular day to complete this flight? You know, this old story of get home items.
All right. Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about another unfortunate accident from which we may be able to learn something. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And Bob, we're going to talk about an article that I understand you took some heat for in the most recent edition, the March edition of Over the Airwaves. But it had nothing to do with the description or examination of what may have caused the accident.
Well, the accident that we're referring to took place up in Maine, Rockland, Maine, when I talked about a pilot, and inappropriately I referred to this pilot as a lady pilot, which I must apologize to all my readers because that added description was not necessary. It had nothing to do with the determination or outcome of the flight. But in any case, I should say the pilot took off in a Piper Cherokee, presumably with the intent of just making a couple of circuits around the pattern. The problem was when she checked weather, the pattern altitude, the ceiling was down to less than 1,000 feet. It was down to, I think, 1,200 feet when she first checked.
Mm-hmm.
And she deliberately waited until the ceiling came up to the 1,000 feet, which is a typical pattern altitude, 1,000 feet AGL. When it did, she climbed into the airplane, made a turn or two around the airport. Witnesses lost sight of her, I think, on the first or second turn when she inadvertently flew into a cloud bank or a fog bank and then promptly went inverted and crashed just short of the field. And the question that I raise is, even though it's, or the point I raise is, even though the field was typically 1 mile clear of clouds and she could do it within the confines of the weather, sometimes the weather winds up being worse than advertised, and sometimes the weather on the ground is not nearly as bad looking as weather in flight. And since she had no back door, she had no instrument skills, it left her with no option. I also mentioned parenthetically in this piece that I wrote that it had been nearly 2 full years. She was legal with her biennial flight review, but she had only flown very, very rarely in the last 2 years and hadn't had a review for nearly 2 years. And of course, I'm on a rant that I believe that all of us pilots, whether it's required or not by regulation, should undergo an annual flight review with somebody who can help to, you know, take the cobwebs off, particularly if we're not flying regularly throughout the season.
Well, this brings up something interesting for me, too, because I found myself kind of in this mindset when I was coming up on time for a flight review. And first of all, the FAA is with you, at least in spirit, on this, Bob, because they no longer call it a biennial flight review. They call it a flight review in the hopes that maybe we will get one more often than biennial.
Well, good point, but it's still required only every 2 years, which is, I'm not sure what they're accomplishing with that. But regardless of what the regulations have to say, I know, Paul, you fly a gyrocopter.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have not flown a gyrocopter in a year, even 6 months, I think it would be just good, prudent management for you to find either a gyrocopter or instructor, or even somebody with who's much more proficient. Now, can you fly those with two people in them? I suspect you can.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And then go around the patch a few times with an experienced pilot, even though you're licensed and rated, but not quite current. This is something that I think goes without saying, but surprisingly, particularly spring in North America is now rapidly approaching, and we're beginning to see people open hangar doors that were closed back in November, and they're climbing into airplanes that they haven't flown for in 4 months, 5 months sometimes. And, man, we scatter. We give them lots of room because no telling where they're going to go sometimes.
As I say, if you have to use WD-40 to get the hangar door open, maybe it's time to go up with an instructor.
That's a good example.
Well, the thing I was going to get to here was that it had been 22 months since her last flight review. I know that when I was about 4 years ago, I was coming up on a flight review deadline, and I actually had been flying fairly regularly. But even so, it was in the back of my mind that, you know, gee, I want to go up and shake a little rust off before I go to my flight review. You know, I wonder how many people get to the point where they've been 22, 23 months out, and they're trying to force it maybe a little bit, forgetting that the flight review is not supposed to be a test.
Well, yeah, and I don't understand that. Some people just avoid thinking that it is a test, thinking that a flight instructor can all of a sudden take their credentials away. There's nothing that negative about a flight review if the individual doesn't fly to the satisfaction of the instructor. He or she simply logs it as instruction given.
Mm-hmm.
But coming back to what makes common sense. Now, on the other hand, I have people that come out and say to me, Bob, I want both instrument pilots and non-instrument rated pilots. Let's go fly and get the dust off. Paul, I fly 5 days, sometimes 6 days a week, but I still go up every year with a good friend of mine who's a designated examiner, a much more experienced pilot than I am, and he shakes whatever bad habits I've developed, tries to shake them off. And I think this is something that we all should be doing, regardless of our skill level.
Well, I will share one thing that happened to me when I flew on a marginal VFR day under circumstances that don't sound a whole lot different from this story. I was up with an instructor, and we had enough margin to do it legally. We were doing some pattern work, and I was on the downwind, about to set up for a landing, and we had a near miss with a plane that was trying to run the Scud with no warning, no radio call, flying over the center of the airport.
That's an unfortunate circumstance, and it obviously could have had tragic outcomes. Anytime we're up in marginal weather like this, we run that risk. But I think the greater risk is not so much the collision. The only thing going for us in your situation or in your example is something called the big sky theory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't need to put a lot of weight in that, but the accident data shows that more often than not, it's the pilot that killed himself when operating too close to the envelope. And this one, it was a rather obvious envelope where she had to wait until the weather rose to just such a point that they could get into the pattern. And also Rockland, Maine. I mean, any of us who've been on the sea coast, on either coast, west coast or east coast, you know, I mean, we have sea breezes and sea fog that rolls in that can obscure an airport without notice.
Mm-hmm.
We have lake effect snows here up in the east side of Lake Erie, even though the ceiling may be well within limits, the visibility may be within limits, but we'll have a snow shower blow through that will completely obscure the field in seconds. So these are things that we have to ponder each time we go up, and these are the things that we like to cover in flight reviews, giving the what-if scenarios. What are you going to do if? You know, what is your back door if? That kind of thing.
Well, Bob, we always wind up with a lot to think about when we finish talking to you, and we appreciate over the airwaves and the work you do there. Talk to you again on Monday.
Thanks, Paul. Talk to you soon.
My guest has been Bob Miller. You can always read the latest edition of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at www.overtheairwaves.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.